north of Fairbanks, and they called the university, and Dr. Dale Guthrie excavated it and brought it in, and it sat in alcohol for about 2 years before taxidermy work was put onto it.
Eric, you're the taxidermist. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that's it.
What have you done with this bison?
Well, it has been mounted in a method called the Dracula method. It was invented by American at the turn of the century, but has been developed quite a lot since. That means that there is done a sculpture in clay of the bison, according to the measurements that has been worked out from the skin and the bones. And then this sculpture is cast, there is made a mannequin, so-called, the positive cast, out of burlap and plaster. Nowadays it's very common to use, for instance, fiberglass, but this burlap and plaster is much more friendly to the skin, and since this is an animal of a very, very great value, it may never get destroyed. So when we have this mannequin, then the tanned skin is stretched over. And that's, yes, it's almost complete. So this bison will be to seen really very three-dimensional, and is made in the position that it had when it had been killed. And what's quite marvelous with it is that we only have three other mammals in about the same age that are made in taxidermy in the world. That's two mammoths from Siberia that are in the Soviet Union. One is an adult male and the other a newborn calf. And then we have a woolly rhinoceros in Poland, and that was found deep salted. It had fell down in a hole in the ground and to a salt layer, and was found in a salt mine. And these mammoths, they are found in permafrost like this bison. And I think it's a real wonder that we can see him again with all his body, about 36,000 years since he died. Yeah.
Now, on this, you say there are three other mammals from this era that have been prepared in the manner you've done. Is that correct?
I don't know what you mean.
You just mentioned three other mammals possibly the same age.
Well, yes, that was the two mammoths I told about, and then the rhino in Poland. So this is the first greater mammal of that age that is made in taxidermy that is shown in the Western world.
That was the point I was getting to.
Yeah.
Now, Harry, can I go back to you? And the animal's 36,000 years old. What do we, very generally, what do we know about this animal as a, what happened to it, why it was there? Do we have any just general science on this animal?
36,000 years ago, it was a tundra steppe grassland, and we had large herds of bison, horse, mammoth. They were the dominant grazers in the Fairbanks region at that time. And bison were just extremely numerous. So it was very fortunate that this one froze as a carcass. And we have a lot of bones in the collection, just assorted bones. And There have been other mummies, mummified carcasses that have been found, but this one I think is the most complete, probably. The Smithsonian has one, and that's partial bison that Otto Geiss found. But at that time, just extensive grasslands. I think that's the bison will help to reconstruct the environment at that time. A lot of work has been done more in the 18, 19, 20,000 year range. And at 36,000, I think the bison's going to fill us in with a lot of the answers that everybody's looking for.
As you said, this is a unique or special addition to the collection.
Definitely is, yeah.
Now, on the bison that you, how long did it take you to reconstruct this animal in your project?
Well, I have worked on it now actually for 6 weeks. And that means that usual work days have not been enough for to do it. It has been very done very fast, in fact. But it was to very, very great help for me that Professor Dale Gatry had done a reconstruction very well of the this bison before, so I could use this reconstruction very much and did not have to spend my time very much with founding out the shape of the bison, only the measurement of it.
Now, you mentioned the other animals. You have worked on this type of an animal before?
No, I haven't worked exactly at this type of an animal before, and that's very easy to understand since they are just these both mammoths in Russia, and the woolly rhino in Poland. But the Russian taxidermist that has done these mammoth baby is actually a good friend of mine also, so I know a lot about the methods that have been used, and otherwise I'm specialized in big game taxidermy for natural history museums, and I have done quite a few reconstructions of extinct animals, so I have these reconstruction works behind me, and then I have been working quite a lot on preservation of paleontological material.
I've jumped around a couple of things before asking more questions. Is there anything that I've triggered one of you would like to say something?
Yeah, I'd like to add something
to the reconstruction. That not only the that the reconstruction was aided by not only the material that we had with the bison, but Eric's knowledge of general anatomy, and by Dale Guthrie reconstructing it through cave paintings in Spain and France, and just a lot of different sources, but not only from the bison that we have. It's just put together by a lot of information from a lot of different directions. So,
did you have something else you'd like to add before I ask?
Well, I don't know if I want to add something.
Why, let me play the devil's advocate for a minute. Why should a museum or any person go to the expense of putting together an animal like this, reconstructing an animal?
Well, that's maybe an easy question to answer, actually. Why shouldn't we tell about the history of our planet, what has happened, and so on? Then when we have the opportunity to show something really that special, that an animal that lived several 10,000 years ago, well, we should show him, of course.
That Alaska is a real unique environment, that we have permafrost, and the reason that this bison in particular was preserved, and that the Russians have found two mammoths in Siberia is because of the permafrost. And there aren't very many regions in the world that have this situation, so it's just an extraordinary find, and it's just a rare situation in the whole world. So taking the opportunity to put the expense and the time into reconstructing the bison scientifically and just for the general public is really interesting.
Now, from our museum viewpoint, is this going to be, would you think this will be a premier or the star of our attraction, one of our stars?
Well, I should also say that it's very easy to say give an answer to that. It's the most precious piece that ever will be shown in this museum. It's absolutely unique in all the Western world, and one of the four in all the world. So it had been very stupid not to put it in an exhibit.
Saying it instead of me saying it. This particular animal, you said it was widespread in Alaska during that era. What caused this extinction?
Well, now we are going to problems that aren't my profession.
Okay, we won't go on.
That would be a Dale Guthrie question. Yes.
On this, now that we have the bison here, it's a nice display, but is the bison more than just a display by museum?
Yeah, the bison goes way beyond just a display. That's for the general public. I think it represents a lot of research being done here at the museum. And it just a lot of potential reconstruction, environmental reconstruction, a better understanding of Bison priscus as an animal through all the research that will be done. Simple things like color of fur, that nobody has ever seen bison priscus fur before, and we have some, and giving answers like that, but it will take quite a while for all the research to be done, and I think the answers that we will have from that will really give us a very good understanding of not only the bison, but the environment that the bison lived in within Alaska.
Anything else you would like to add, Eric? I would like for you to do one last thing for me. Would you say your name and the way you've been here so I can have it reconstructed on my radio show?
Yes, my name is Eric Granqvist, and I'm working at the Zoological Museum of the University of Helsinki in Finland.
Two questions, Dr. Hedrick. First one. How did the legislative funding play any role in this that was significant?
Steve, without legislative support that we've had at the University of Alaska Museum and indeed at UAF, we would be unable literally to do what we have done with the bison priscus. By having the monies which the past legislature and the current legislature evidently will be giving to us, we have been able to salvage the bison. We've been able to bring in an expert to mount the bison in a very lifelike pose, and we will now be able to literally exhibit it so that people for the first time ever in the world will see what a 36,000-year-old bison looked like. It's a very thrilling thing for us, and again, to answer your question directly, without legislative funding, or university funding, we would have been unable to do it. We're very grateful. There were only two probabilities, or possibilities even. The carcass had remained in a solution which kept it viable, but this was the last year. We would have had literally to either let it go to ruin, rot as it were, or send it to another institution outside of Alaska to be taken care of, and that was just unmentionable. So happily, as usual, the Alaskans banded together and we saved it.
Now, on something like this, give you a chance to clear yourself. On something like this, it's nice to have this on exhibit. It's nice to have a pretty you know, an old animal for the people to look at. But is that all an animal like this does for us?
On the contrary, what we're going to do here initially, it has a certain curiosity effect, and that we're putting it out and exhibiting it temporarily until such time as we're able to fit it in to the entire Pleistocene era display and exhibit, which we will be doing at the earliest possible fiscal and temporal moment. This is a huge exhibit that is going to be done, huge in the sense of the content, and it's going to require a substantial amount of changing in the exhibit hall. It isn't only just to see what a bison from 36,000 years ago looked like, it's to see what perhaps if there were humans in this area at that time, what would have been going on, the animal life, the mammalogy of that day, the paleontology of that day, the archaeology, if you will. In short, it will draw on all of the sciences in the research section of the museum, and this is what we're all about here. The many people, and quite rightly, consider the University of Alaska Museum to be a very fine exhibit hall for art, history, and even animal life. But what must be remembered is that our underpinnings are very strongly in the research and science areas, in many of the ologies, if you will, mammalogy, paleontology, geology, on and on. We are a very strong research component of UAF, and the exhibits are but the tip of the research iceberg that is showing to the public. That is how it fits in.
Thank you. See, we have registration coming up fairly quickly. Could you tell me when registration is?
Registration is September 4th and 5th. Students in the Fairbanks area can begin to pick up registration materials on August 31st. First, 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. will be set up in the Scheibel Auditorium. I think the students coming in to the residence housing from out of town over the weekend will be glad to know that we'll also be giving out registration materials on Labor Day, September 3rd, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. And then on the 4th and 5th, we give materials out from 8 to 4 on the 4th and from 8 to 6 on the 5th. The actual selection of classes and payment of fees will occur on the 4th and 5th, and once again, as has been our practice, students will be assigned to the course card area and to the fee payment area based on their current semester's class standing, with our highest class standing students having the earliest registration times.
What does it look like we're going to have fair size enrollment this year?
Well, it's very difficult to estimate our enrollment for this year. We have been running behind in the number of applications received and accepted until this past week. And we are have finally surpassed the number of applications received and are well to on the way to catch up in the number of applications accepted. So we could come out to be about the same or more than we had last year. I don't at all expect a decrease. We doubled our application for admission fee this year, and I think that probably impacted the number of applications submitted. In other words, students who would normally shop around and send in an application for $10 if they weren't really seriously considering the University of Alaska would probably wait and not send one in when it costs $20. So I think we probably have a more serious group of applicants. So we really, it's really a hard one to call. Like I say, I know we're not going to be any less. It's hard to say how much more we will be.
Are there any other changes in the fees for students this year? Tuition or anything like that?
Yeah.
It's 360.
There was an increase in the fees for students this semester. On a per credit basis, which is the basis for fee assessment up to 12 credits, a resident student for undergraduate credit pays $30 or $60 for graduate credit. And the consolidated fee for students carrying 12 credits or more for undergraduate resident students is $360, and for a graduate student carrying all graduate credit is $540. Anyway you look at it, it's still quite a bargain considering the costs of attending college. So a student in the local area really essentially can go to school for $360 plus books, and that's not too expensive.
Do you have any idea how that compares to other schools?
Oh, definitely very low. Even our non-resident tuition is low in comparison to other institutions. And I think the university's made an effort to keep the tuition low for the benefit of the in-state students, and also to offset the slightly higher charges for room and board that we are obliged to charge. Although I found that in many outside institutions, their room and board charges are the same as ours, are even higher. So we can say to a student on the East Coast, for example, that they can go to the University of Alaska as cheaply or cheaper than they can go to an East Coast school, including their round trip airfare from their home to Alaska and back.
Let's cover one figure you may want to use. It's cheaper for a Colorado resident to come here to school than to go to University of Colorado.
We're still awfully cheap.
Yeah, and then people arrive about $60.
Yeah, I think
the state can't find $60.
Oh, I know. I think Richard's, where he goes, the out-of-state tuition is something like $1,700 a semester or something. Just
still.
Yeah.
On the this fall, you say you anticipate no drop in enrollment. What was last fall's enrollment?
Last fall we had an enrollment of 4,622 students, and that compared to 4,529 for the previous year. We've had a steady increase in the number of students attending the University of Alaska Fairbanks over the years, and I anticipate that will still hold true. We have new housing opening up, and that certainly is going to allow more students to attend the university. And we do feel that we should have an increase, so that's what we're projecting, a slight increase.
Do you anticipate in the registration and classes, are there going to be any bottlenecks and a lot of closed classes this year? Let me back up. Well, we have a lot of closed classes,
yeah.
And where will they be?
Yes, we will have closed classes. As a matter of fact, we already have several classes closed as a result of the pre-registration that was held in April. The first ones to go, of course, are the sections of Speech 111, which is a basic communication requirement for all degrees. Some of the English 111 sections that are, again, a basic communication requirement are near filling, and some are filled. They'll fill very quickly once the new freshmen start to register. Our computer science courses are very popular, and some of those are filled. There's some math sections filled. And I think that right at the present time we have about 40 closed classes, including some laboratory sections.
And this is out of roughly 1,200 that we offer this semester?
Yes, about. Mm-hmm.
And you anticipate quite a few more closing?
Yes, there will be quite a few. I think also that some of the deans are waiting to see what happens with the enrollment the first day or so, and they have some resources to open some new sections of some of the more popular courses. I know in the case of English, the head of the English department is ready to open a few more sections of English 111 if necessary. So hopefully we'll be able to accommodate most of the requests that we receive for classes.
About upper division and graduate classes, are they closing out now too?
No, they have not. They do not close as fast. However, some of them will close, I suspect, by the end of the first day of regular registration, which is when the upper division and graduate students register. That's September 4th.
Outside of the College of Liberal Arts.
Yeah.
Remember, it was College of Arts and Sciences and College of Arts and Social Sciences.
Isn't it College of Arts and Social Sciences now?
It's College of Liberal Arts.
You're kidding.
It got changed in a matter of weeks.
Oh, no.
Like 2 weeks after College of Arts and Natural Blue.
Somebody realized their mistake.
Well, so it's not College of Liberal Arts.
I don't think we knew that, and I know we've got that wrong. Shoot.
I'll call it back. I'll confirm that.
Yeah, would you?
Yeah. But anyway, outside of the College of Liberal Arts, what units have the greatest impact and will have the greatest enrollment this year? Well, what units are we going to have a lot of in? Are we going to be seeing a lot of closed classes in business? Are we going to see a lot of agriculture? That's what I'm getting at.
Well, the interest in the last several years has swung to the professional schools. With the School of Business, or School of Management rather, with the Business Administration and the Accounting majors have been very popular. Engineering, all phases of it have increased dramatically over the last several years. And even our School of Education enrollment has increased when that has been in a decline everywhere else in the nation. But here we found that this is where the emphasis for our students is at the present time. In the College of Liberal Arts at the present time, I should mention that the computer science department is growing incredibly fast. It's a new program. The new Bachelor of Science in Computer Science is just a year old. They've just improved a Master of Science degree, and it is probably right now our fastest growing department. And I expect that it will continue to grow until it reaches a capacity of just not enough space to accommodate all of the terminals and the computers that are needed to support the program.
I've jumped around quite a bit. Is there anything else you'd like to add or something I didn't ask you that should be included?
There will be a printing of the class schedule in the local newspaper on the 29th of August. And in that schedule will be a number of courses offered in the evening, and we particularly are interested in people from the community knowing about these courses. There are also several courses listed that are available by TV, and the TV courses require watching a program once a week for the class, and then meeting with the instructor ever so often, not every week during the semester, but some meetings during the semester with the instructor up on the campus. And I do encourage anyone who is interested in taking a shot at a college course and may be a little hesitant about coming out into a classroom situation to take a look at the courses by TV and trying one of those. It's a good place to start.